Welcome to the first episode of Too Late to Die Young with me, Nina Mishkoff. Each week I talk to a celebrated guest who, like me, is at that time of life when they are closer to the end than the beginning. Today it's superstar singer and actor Roger Daltrey. As lead singer with rock band The Who, he famously sang, and I'm not going to attempt it, "Hope I Die Before I Get Old." Well, fortunately, he didn't, and along with so many of our generation, is still very much alive and kicking as he approaches the age of 75.
Yeah, I quite like funerals. They're better than weddings.
Why?
Well, a funeral, you go to every funeral, everybody turns up, they all say nice things about the person who's dead, and they all go down the pub, everybody's pleased to see each other because they haven't seen each other for a long time.
And they're grateful to be there.
And they're grateful to be alive. Yeah, I prefer funerals.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll. In today's episode, we talk about his bandmates Pete Townsend and Keith Moon and Keith's outrageous skirmishes with fellow drinker actor Oliver Reed, his tough beginnings, his broken back and his wife Heather, and the feeling of peace that he had when, just a few years ago, he thought he was going to die. We met last December in his office in North London, not long after his autobiography, Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kilperwhite, was published. I'd interviewed him 20 years before, and before that.
How long have we known each other now?
Well,
40 years?
It's ridiculous. We first met when I came to interview you, and it was the time of McVicar, so it must have been 1980. And we were supposed to have lunch at Brown's Hotel in Mayfair. I turned up there, and it was hilarious because we went into the dining room. You were wearing a beautiful leather jacket, and the maitre d' said, "Sorry, sir, you can't come in and eat unless you're wearing a tie." So you got into a bit of a strop, and we stormed off to the suite upstairs, and you said, "Right, I'm going to order the most expensive bottle of wine on the room service menu." and we drank it.
Oh, good.
And then I think we had a second bottle. It was a terrific interview from what I remember of it, which isn't that much, really. And all these years have gone by, and we're still here.
Just about.
And you said to me, well, we bumped into each other at Radio 2,
right,
where you've been promoting your memoirs. I've been a bit anxious because I've been having to look back. And so the whole process of writing the book has made you reassess your whole life, has it?
Yeah, it's weird. It is weird. It does leave you in a funny space. You know, I've been offered fortunes to write a biography for years. And I wrote this without even a publishing deal because I didn't know I had a book in me. And I didn't feel I'd done enough. But for me, living it, I just imagine that everybody's life is like that. You know, why not?
I don't think so, Roger.
I wish everybody's was. It was that.
Would humanity survive?
It would be great. It just is. It is strange because you have to be very, very honest, and you do expose yourself.
But the thing is, in having to look back, it actually makes you realise how many years have passed, and therefore the actual age you are.
Well, I'm kind of 21 in my head, but then you look in the mirror and you go, ah!
I blame you and Pete, actually.
It's all our fault.
The fact that the baby boomers, and I'm a baby boomer, I'm only 2 years younger than you. You were born during the war. I was born just 9 months after the end of it. So I'm a classic baby boomer. And when I hear my generation, I'm immediately transported back to my student days. I could see where I was. And it was, don't fade away. And, you know, hope I die before I get old. And our generation has not faded away. And so the younger generation loathe that because here we still are.
Oh, we're in the way. Yeah, no, we're certainly in the way. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was the worst question to be asked when you were sort of, you know, how old was I? I was 21 when I sang that song, 21 or 22. And they used to say, well, do you really mean it? You know, you hope you die before you get old. I said, well, I never really saw it as how old you are in years. It's mentally old.
At what point when you were singing did you suddenly think that's a bit ironic?
I've never ever thought that.
Good.
That age in the song was always for me like the age of your brain, you know, the age of your thinking. one of the biggest problems with our age group, we haven't grown old mentally. We still behave like teenagers. Oh, dear.
Do you think we've grown up?
Well, of course you do. I mean, your families make you grow up, and life gives you the knocks that form you. But hopefully the spirit that we all had, we had an incredibly privileged time in history to live through. That's one thing this book has done for me. It really made me realise that perhaps our generation had the most golden period of probably any generation ever to live through.
Because of the sexual revolution?
No, for everything. Just for the time. The fact that we came out of that war with everything levelled. You know, and when everything's flattened, the only thing you can do is rebuild. So all we did through our lives was build. And look what we did build. It was the first time adolescents and young adults had money to spend, so that whole industry sprang up, music industry, the fashion industry. So,
and media on the back of that.
And media on the back. The BBC got hold of it, of course.
What do you mean by that, Roger?
Well, you know, I'd always loathed it once they sunk the pirate ships. I mean, that was the worst thing that ever happened, I think, to pop music. Those ships and the guys, the DJs, were real music fans. You know, it wasn't just a 9-to-5 job to them. And they used to suffer for their music, let's be honest. If you've ever been out in the English Channel, that was no picnic. I mean, so they had to be music fans, yeah. And they used to find new music, and they'd continually be passionate about it. As soon as the BBC got it, it became kind of, you know, aunties in charge. Don't you remember it? It was kind of an incredibly sad period, I felt.
But you were kind of at the epicentre of all of that, so you must have just had a ball.
Oh, it was amazing, but equally underneath it was the dramas in the band, and it's a serious job, especially when you come from absolutely nothing. Your only chance of having any life outside the factory is what you're doing as a musician in a band that's, if it lasts till the end of the week at the time, was a miracle. So it was all very, you know, very, very finely balanced. So it kept us on our toes, kept me on my toes, that's for sure.
At school, you were this kind of shrimpy kid that was, you moved, had to move schools and establish different relationships, yeah. And you were bullied, and that can't have been easy. That must have given you a real fire, either to get out or to do something.
I think the worst thing was moving from Shepherd's Bush into Chiswick. And even though it's only about a mile and a half in distance, the two different societies were extraordinary. The part of Chiswick I grew up in was just bordering on South Acton. And it was all bedsit, so very transient people. There was no street community as such. There was a few mates I met locally after a few years. But in Shepherd's Bush, they're all, you know, three families per house, and everybody was rooted. And so all the streets were very communal. Everybody knew everybody. Nobody locked their door and all that. And, of course, this kind of bedsit area, you never saw anyone on the street in the daytime. It was dead, absolutely dead. And that, for an 11-year-old, 12-year-old boy, was kind of devastating. And I went to a school where no one spoke Cockney. They were all, "Eh, hello." And very brain-tracked.
Brain-tracked.
Very brain-tracked. And I just felt, you know, completely out of place. And being small, and yes, I did used to look funny. I broke my jaw, which was a kind of, twisted it all up. Jonathan Miller described my face as, he looks like a police identity photograph. Because it's all lopsided and bent, you know, everything's been broken. And so, you know, being small, you got picked on. And in the grammar school system of those days, of course, the first form going in, you used to have to fetch and get for the sixth form. So you were called a fag. Not a good name, but and expected to do their bidding. Well, that didn't go down very well with someone like me, you know. Ask nicely and I might do it for you, but not the way they treated us. I got bullied, and after sort of a year of that, I picked up a chair and hit someone with it. And it kind of, they all backed off. You know, the only chance you've got, if the guy's bigger than you, is to get the first punch in, you know, the Glaswegian handshake.
You channeled all that energy into...
And then I found music. Well, at the same time, I was finding music in Shepherd's Bush with my skiffle band, with my mates from the street. And there was the Solgrave Boys Club on the Goldhawk Road.
I know that. Yeah. It's just by that roundabout.
Yeah. I used to rehearse in there. Yeah. So that was great. I used to go there every night. That was my saviour. And I was in that group with probably one of the first guys who ever didn't really bully me, but he was always kind of picking on him. Reggie Chaplin, who came from a really rough family in Shepherd's Bush. He was the one that instigated letting go of the blanket when they threw me in the air in the Boys Brigade camp. And I came crashing down to earth 15 foot up. And I think that's when I broke my back.
Oh my God. And which wasn't discovered until...
No, it wasn't discovered until 2007 or something, I don't know.
You ended up in hospital in Miami?
In Florida. And the doctor came and said, So, Mr. Daughtry, when did you break your back? I said, well, I haven't. He said, well, I beg to differ. And he showed me the x-ray. There it was, you know, one broken back, one not very careful owner.
And you'd lived all your life with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, but I'd had so many bad falls anyway. I've been very lucky. I mean, I must have lived at least six of my lives. But I survived, you know, I got lucky. When I got hit in the eye at Hyde Park by Gary Glitter, he hit me in the eye with a microphone stand that he was swinging around his head. The foot of the microphone stand, if it had hit me half an inch more to the side, it would have killed me. I mean, a microphone stand weighs about 10 pounds, and he was swinging it. It came around his head, went, doom, right in my eye socket.
Oh, my God.
And I broke my cheekbone, and God, this has seen the shiner. It was wonderful. And it knocked me out for 20 minutes, that one. Completely knocked me up in the air, my feet off the ground, everything. But if that had been half an inch further over to the left and hit me in the temple, that would have been good night, Rog.
But you went on stage the next night, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, there was a quarter of a million people who booked for this show in Hyde Park. There's Bob Dylan and Eric Clapton and us.
But you went on stage with a patch?
I put a patch over it with a cotton wool thing.
Like almost like Johnny Depp as a pirate or something with the bullseye.
Well, yeah, people thought it was part of the show. it was actually holding my eyeball in. My eyeball kept trying to leave my head. It's very easy to take your eye out, you know. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, it is. But that's... They can lay them on your cheek.
Roger, don't tell me that.
And you'll be looking at your belly button, you know, and you won't even know they've taken it out if they anaesthetise you. It's just unbelievable how easily they come out. And with a broken cheekbone, they pop out quite easily, especially when you're straining to get a high note. You know, it was a little bit weird. And I was rattling like a maraca because I'd taken so many painkillers. But it was a good gig.
How have you survived? How have you survived? And how have you...
Luck. It can only be luck and determination, I suppose.
But also, thinking of the life you've led, of the four of you in The Who... You turned out to be the sensible one.
Yeah, I suppose I did. I was with three addicts. You know, Keith was, he was addicted to everything. Pete was an alcoholic, who then became addicted to, you know, hard drugs. John, again, was a cocaine addict and an alcoholic. Someone had to be straight. Someone had to be straight to keep... to keep the ground straight for them to walk on. And that was me.
But why were you the one that had the feeling of...
I had nothing else in my life if that had failed. I got married at 19, had a child at 19. And so that responsibility sat very heavily on me. So I'd always have to provide there. And we weren't poor, we were wealthy because we had incredible community. But we had no money. So the responsibility of earning a living and putting the bread on the table has always sat very heavy with me. Simple as that.
Do you think you grew up in a little way with the birth of your son?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, definitely. But equally, I had to walk away from it to give them any chance of having any kind of half-decent life, because we were living in one room of a council flat in Wandsworth with the mother-in-law in the other bit of the flat. That was hard, and I thought the only way I'm going to get them out of there is if I follow my dream. And if I follow my dream, I can't do this life. I tried it. I couldn't be married. I had to go and be free. And I went back and I got them out of the council flat, and they had a very nice house and they've all done very well.
But you couldn't have done anything else. You had to go.
Well, you could fold up and just live in one room of the council flat for the rest of your life. Some people do.
But that not you.
Not me.
That was Roger Daltrey. We'll rejoin Roger in a moment. I just want to pause here while I say thank you to our sponsors. Well, a big thank you to Imodine, our sponsors for this episode, and I'm happy to tell you about a product that I actually use myself. In fact, I've taken Imodine skincare supplements since they were launched here in the UK in 1991. That's a long time. I was in my mid-40s and I had a column in You magazine testing out beauty products. So when Imodine arrived, I was curious. I mean, it wasn't a moisturiser or anything you used on the skin, but pills especially formulated for the skin, for radiance from within, they said. Well, I was a bit sceptical, like you would be, but took the pills every day for 3 months and was photographed barefaced before and after. Well, very brave, frankly. I genuinely felt you could see a difference, a sort of, a radiance, softer lines. Imodine supplied me with the product for a year afterwards, very nice people, but I've bought it myself since. Recently, I had my skin density and collagen levels tested in-store in Boots with the Imodine ultrasound scanning system. It's free, and they test it on your wrist rather than on your face, and the results were excellent. My collagen levels were those of somebody much younger. People seem genuinely surprised when they hear my age, and I am, I have to say, when I look in the mirror. So I'm sticking with Imodine. Too Late to Die Young with me, Nina Mishkoff. Today, it's superstar and singer Roger Daltrey.
How did you survive Keith?
How did I survive Keith? Oh, Keith was adorable, but equally he was infuriating. Everything about his personality was enormous. He was the most generous, the most mean. He was the most loving, the most hateful. Everything was juxtaposed. And just having a night out with Keith could take you through so many emotions. I can remember once we did a show in Edmonton in Canada, and for some reason we went back after the show and the hotel laid on a meal for us because we didn't used to eat until kind of midnight. So we went back to the hotel and there's a huge table and all the roadies and all the road crew, we're all eating together. There must have been about 40 of us around this table. And Moon comes in halfway through and he takes the head of the table. And he's dressed in a white suit, and he looked like a kind of southern senator. And he starts getting up and behaving like a southern senator and doing this kind of political speech. And I used to take photos at the time, so I get down on my knees in front of him while I'm photographing him. I think, I've got to get this log down. Anyway, Pete puts up with this for about 5 minutes, and then gets up and says, it's a shame you didn't put as much energy into the show as you've just put into this. And stormed out. We were all loving what Keith was doing because he was very funny. Oh my God, Keith immediately turned to jelly and started crying. You know, broke him up. I said, come on, it's all right, don't take no notice of him. It was really funny and you played really well tonight. This wasn't a bad show. It wasn't one of our best, but it wasn't a bad show. I took him up to his room and I sat there talking to him. I said, Heather was with me. I said, be down in a minute. 4 hours later, I'm still talking to Keith. No, Keith, it's really all right. I mean, he really didn't mean it. And I took him down and talked him down. Keith now kind of come round and he's poured himself another brand in it. And he suddenly says, I noticed you were taking photos of me when I was doing that. He said, well, who owns the photographs? Because you've got photos of me in there. I said, well, I do. It's my film, my camera, and I've taken them. He said, well, you can't do that. So he's gone from this gibbering, crying wreck.
Grateful to you for...
grateful to me for talking to him for fucking hours. And he says, I'm not happy with that. He says, you'll have to have a contract. I'm going to call my lawyer in the morning, and I'd like you to leave now. So I did. I mean, that's what he was like. You never knew which bit of him was... Oh, it was like, what the fuck? And when I went down, it was like 5 o'clock in the morning. I said, she said, what happened? I said, oh, you won't believe it. She wouldn't.
Well, at least he wasn't blowing the hotel room up. Or
No one got blown up that night.
I mean, the classic one, stories that everybody knows, are that, was it the Cadillac in the swimming pool?
I'm not sure whether that ever did happen. Mm. I think there's a lot about Keith Moon that was probably myth. He was a publicist's dream, you know, especially when he teamed up with Oliver Reed. I mean, it was a dream team for newspapers. I mean, the tabloids today would have had a field day with them.
Well, that was for Tommy, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But they were those huge drinkers and vast personalities. How they lived through that, God knows.
They nearly didn't. Keith Altham, you know, he's a very good friend of ours, used to be
publicist.
The editor of... Our publicist, but he used to be the editor of NME in the early days. He took a photographer down to photograph Keith and Ollie at Ollie's place. Oliver Reed owned a big rectory. Not a rectory, what was it? A nunnery, a priory. And Keith went down, and Keith dressed up in a jester's outfit, you know, court jester's outfit.
Oh, with the bells.
Yeah. But anyway, they had a drinking competition, and this photographer's taking photos of them, and he's taking photos, and Ollie had a lake with an island on it.
Of course he had.
And so he says, what about getting in the boat, and I'll take some photos of you two in the boat, right, rowing on the lake. Keith and Ollie get in the boat, and they row on the lake, and the photographer takes photographs, and it goes back round the island, and there's a whole load of noises from behind the island, and Oliver Reed comes around without Keith on the boat. So, then it goes round again, then there's another whole load of noises, and then Keith comes round on the boat without Ollie. So anyway, this was almost going absolutely nuts trying to get, you know, a decent shot. So then they decide to go to the pub at the end of Oliver Reed's drive. I mean, only Ollie could have a pub at the end of his drive. Apart from Keith Moon, who also had a pub at the end of his drive. And it was the day when they were having the referendum whether we joined the common market. Do you remember that day?
Absolutely.
And there was a tent set up outside the pub for people to go and vote. Keith and Ollie went in there. Keith dressed as a jester. And a pretend fight broke out in the tent. The tent collapsed. Out of all this kind of bubbling mess of canvas, Keith pops his head out with a joker's hat on, and Oliver Reed pokes his head out above it, and the photographer went smack, and he said, this is brilliant. He said, this is more exciting than the Vietnam War. That was his comment. He said it's complete madness. I don't know whether they'd get away with it today.
I don't think they would.
No, they wouldn't.
But listen, but then you lived through all of that, but then of course, Keith died young. I can remember, I had just started on The Sun, I was The Sun's Queen of Pop that year, and I remember the news came through that Keith had died. I'd interviewed Pete about 2 months before that at the Mayor Barber place that he lived, and he'd given me a phone number, so I remember I rang him up, and he answered the phone, and I said, I'm terribly sorry to call. He said, no, he said, I'm sitting here waiting for anybody to call me, and nobody has. He didn't talk to anybody else at all. But it must have been dreadful for you, or had you been expecting it?
The last 4 years of his life, there was several narrow squeaks where he was very, very lucky not to have died. So when it came, it was even more of a shock for some reason, because you always thought, oh, he'd get through it. He kind of had 9 lives, he really did. But for us, we were devastated. I mean, it was just hollow, horrible feeling, really horrible feeling. But then you think about what you do as a group and what you've created, and you think, well, we've still got the music. And for me, the music was always everything. And by then, you know, Pete had created some of the greatest work in rock, you know, not particularly rock and roll, in rock of the 20th century. And so you thought, well, we can hang on to that, and who knows where it'll end up. And And here we are now. Mm-hmm. So there you go, and it's been fantastic. You know, we can still play the music well, and it's, the music still lives and breathes and touches people. That's all that matters in the end.
Pete must have been difficult to deal with down the years.
It's not easy. He's an intellectual, and he really, people use the word genius too easy, but he really is a genius, there's no doubt about that. And it can be very, very difficult sometimes with Pete. But equally, I recognise his talent, and I have a deep affection for him, you know, as a human being. Because he's incredibly sensitive. And he does an awful lot of stuff that you never hear about behind the scenes for a lot of disadvantaged people, you know.
I've never read a single word about that.
No, why should you Google it?
Mm. You know. Because, you have an image of people and...
Who always did? I mean, right from the 70s, when Harold Wilson and his government put the taxes up, the WHO decided that there was no point working for money in Britain. We'd take enough to live on, and all the rest of our money would go to charity. That's when we set up the 00 charity. If you look back at the posters, all those football stadiums we did and all that, all went to start really good charities that are still around today. You know, there was Erin Pizzi's abuse charity.
The Refuge, was it in Chiswick?
The Refuge in Chiswick. We bought her first house in Chiswick. Nordoff Robbins. I'm very proud that we were at the forefront of getting those things started. So we took enough money to get us to the 83% tax rate, and all the rest went to charity. The government still didn't bloody well get it, you know. And we never left Britain.
You must be one of the few.
We were the only band that didn't leave. Everybody else left. We should have left.
But then a lot of those vast tours that you did of the States, you didn't end up earning money from them. I mean, nowadays...
Well, we were smashing up the equipment, which was very expensive. And for years there, people assumed we were millionaires, but it wasn't until probably 72, 73 that we... You know, my first solo album was the first real money I made. Sold very well, yeah. We had some money before that from overseas, but not from Britain. And that was good. I mean, because we hadn't have to live on them, we were living very well. I mean, you know, I've got a big house, but it cost me 39.5 grand. I mean, everybody thinks we're all multi-millionaires. So I pay no money for my house, and I still live in it today.
How many years later is that?
47.
Really?
I like it.
Well, exactly. The thing about the touring business, you've had a 50th anniversary tour, and nowadays you can make more money touring than you can from selling records, is that right?
There's no record business there. Yeah. I mean, it's gone. I mean, the biggest robbery in history, the internet stealing, the record industry was unbelievable. I mean, you need something like, I don't know, a billion streams to earn yourself £1,000 or something. It's just a joke. Why musicians are expected to work for free, I don't know. But it seems to be that way now, except for the live stage. But that's all right, we can still do it live. We might do one next year, I'm not sure whether we will, but we might do one. But there won't be many more to come, that's for sure.
What about your voice? How do you keep your voice going? Because so many people have screwed their voices up. I mean, without naming names, Paul McCartney, for instance, his voice is fairly shot, sadly. But
is it? I'm going to see him on Sunday. He's invited me to his show at the O2.
Oh, God, don't say I said that, then.
Well, all singers have bad nights, you've got to remember. It's a tough thing on the voice. Some nights will be better than others. Voices are incredibly fragile bits of the body. Those two vocal cords that collide with the force of a kind of heavyweight boxer's punch at something like 11,000 times per second on a high note. It's extraordinary what voices do. Because I've heard Paul, he did a show for Teenage Cancer Trust about 4 years ago, and he was fabulous. He didn't sound bad at all. But equally, I've heard him bad, but you've heard me bad.
I don't think I have.
You have, and I've heard me bad. We all have our off nights, but it's a really weird thing when you've got the crowd in the hall, you've woken up, you don't feel quite right, and by the time you get to the gig, you don't want to cancel the show because the crowd's in the hall. It's a nightmare for a singer. So you go on and you try. And if you've got a cold coming, it's fatal to try and sing on a cold. But you're catch 22, aren't you? That's what I think started the year that I ended up getting meningitis. We had a gig in Cardiff. And I'd woken up in the morning and I had a bit of a cold. And I phoned up my throat guy. And he said, do this, do that. And I did it. But come the evening, and the crowd are in the hall, I had gotten worse. What I should have done was cancel the show, but I didn't. I went out and I tried to sing. The strain on my body and my, just to get any kind of noise out. Because you know, it's the trying.
It's the straining at it.
It's the mental, yeah. And I just screwed myself up completely. I don't know, I had a really bad, really funny year, because we were right in the middle of a tour. My voice took about 3 months to come back to anything. But when I tried to sing, I couldn't get above a Johnny Cash note. Down in my boots, and it's really weird. I'd strained so hard, I put my neck out. It was pushing on my vocal cords. And no matter what I did with chiropractors, all that kind of stuff that I normally do, could not move it. So I got recommended a man called Jan de Bruin in Amsterdam. I go over to Amsterdam and there's this guy with hammer and chisel.
You're kidding.
And he gets hold of my neck and he writes some stuff on my back and he goes down my back and just sound like a stonemason late on the orders, you know. And but he got into my neck and he hammered it and it was fine, absolutely fine. When he got to the point that was stuck, it just went and you can hear it moving. And I did the O2 the same night and it was incredible that I could sing again. And then that lasted all summer, and then we had a few hot gigs in Europe, and we played in Paris in 44 degrees. And by the end of August that year, I crawled into the London clinic with meningitis. You know.
When are we talking about? What year was this?
That was about 3 years ago. I remember. Brain goes a bit blank after that, I tell you. Don't recommend you get that. That was no fun. I was in hospital for a month and I didn't think I was going to make it.
Did you feel that you literally weren't going to make it?
That certainly was the price of death. My blood count was, white blood cells were like non-existent. They thought I had leukemia. They didn't know what I had. They tested me for everything. I had tubes coming out of everywhere. Nothing was working. I didn't see any lights at the end of tunnels. No, I'm going down.
You were going down to the darkness rather than
right, okay, exactly. It was a kind of weird, weird period.
How did you feel? Did you feel worried, anxious, depressed?
No, not really. I just thought about what an incredible life I'd had. And I'd been writing this biography for like 3 years prior to that. But it was the meningitis that kind of encouraged me to finish the bloody thing.
Did you fear the thought of death?
No, never have. No, it's something we all got to do. Life is a long queue to death. But I suddenly thought back to, I used to have a wonderful masseuse that I used to take on the road in the late 80s. And she was a little Austrian lady. She used to massage the knots out of me because we used to do 3-hour shows in those days. And she used to elbow the knots out. And when she used to find a particularly hard one, she said, why are you hanging on to it? She said, once you let go, it's easy. And for some reason or the other, in all the agony I was in and everything else, that message came to me. And I thought, that's such a fantastic life. Can't be much more. Just let, you know, just call up people that you love, tell them you love them, and let go. And then it was incredible peace came on me. It was really weird. No lights at the end of tunnels, but it was like being wrapped in cotton wool. Really weird. Really weird.
Had you made all your arrangements, you know, in case you died? Have you written a will?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I thought about. I've left all my kids okay. Well, Everything's okay. I don't leave anyone in debt. I don't owe anybody any money. Right.
Have you sorted out your funeral? Do you know what you want?
I don't want a bloody funeral. That's one thing I don't want.
No, really?
I'm going to put me in perhaps the recyclable. I don't know. What's left of my body won't be worth having, so there's no point in donating that.
You're very fit, Roger, though.
I am very fit, but it's been chopped up too much, you know. Yeah.
I mean, I've actually thought what I'd like, if I'm going to be cremated, I'd like to be put in a rocket and set off from the top of Primrose Hill.
You know,
I love Primrose Hill and just go out in a burst of stars.
Oh, right. Okay.
No?
No, I don't know. I don't even want a funeral. I don't know.
But you must have gone to lots of funerals, or have you?
Yeah, I quite like funerals. They're better than weddings.
Why? That's a very, very cynical view of marriage, surely.
Well, we used to play a lot of weddings when we were starting up as a band, and quite a lot of the weddings used to end up in fights. And I could never work out quite why. It's obviously because, you know, people used to get drunk and then make passes at other people's women and all that. And they quite often used to end up in punch-ups. Well, a funeral, we go to every funeral. Everybody turns up. They all say nice things about the person who's dead. Then they all go down the pub. Everybody's pleased to see each other because they haven't seen each other for a long time.
And they're grateful to be there.
They're grateful to be alive. So they all go home happy. You know, so, yeah, I prefer funerals.
You mentioned children and you mentioned weddings. And that first time we met when we sank those bottles of wine in the suite at Brown's Hotel. You mentioned your publicist, Keith Altham. I had actually, some months before, been interviewing another client of Keith Altham's, Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues. And for some reason, he wanted to tell me about this child he'd fathered when he was a teenager. And he'd never told anybody about it. That's why he'd written Nights in White Satin for this child whom he'd never seen. He'd never, wow, never knew him. And obviously slightly pissed and shouting about it. I said to you, I don't suppose you've got a love child anywhere stashed away. And you paused a bit and you said, well, as a matter of fact, I have. I've got a boy in Sweden.
Yes.
And I thought, wow. And what you said to me was that you all go on holiday together.
Yeah, I tried to keep it all tight as possible together as a one family, you know. I've got three daughters that turned up when I was 50. You know, from the 60s. They're all wonderful people. They've all had wonderful lives. They were adopted. I didn't know they were there. What can you do? You can't put the clock back and change things. You have to live with what is now, and you have to do your best by people. And that's what I try to do. I can never be a real father to them. I can't be Dad, but I can be Roger, and I can love them and care about them. Got 15 grandchildren.
No, 15? Yeah. It's a bit excessive, right?
But one of my daughters has got six kids.
There's a sort of cliche, what would you do more of if you could live your life again? And an awful lot of people say, I wouldn't spend as much time at the office and I'd have more sex.
But I mean, well, everybody says more sex. I mean, even John Betjeman, I wish I'd had more sex. I mean, I think back to the Cuban crisis. I was only, 16 years old? We were almost under a 4-minute warning of a nuclear war. We all just went out and shagged.
Right, fair enough.
I got laid for the first or second time. I don't know.
So you have Fidel Castro to thank for your first shag. You and Heather, your wife, have been together for how long now?
Living together, 51 years.
Wow. Mm. But that's an extraordinary thing in this
she's
business.
She's an extraordinary woman. She is an extraordinary woman.
Jimi Hendrix, you was almost a rival, in fact. Did you?
The night I took her home, Jimmy had been trying to date Heather for months, and he had no success.
Did he write Foxy Lady for her?
Yes. Well, Heather was best friends with Jimmy's girlfriend, Devon. Wonderful, wonderful girl from Milwaukee. Mm. Wonderful sense of humour. All those girls in the gang that we used to know were fabulous women. All of them. And I still see them today. Mm. And the night I took her home, he was, come home with me. And she said to me, can I come and stay at your place? I said, of course you can. And she came back with me. I almost knew straight away that this was someone very special in my life. On the pillow in the morning, there was this mop of curly hair. She went, "Ah, your hair." In those days, I used to straighten my hair because I had curly hair. And to be a mod with curly hair was, you know, equivalent to having some STD. You can't be a mod with curly hair. So I used to put this dippity-doo stuff on it to keep it straight. And I immediately went, trying to cover it up and run out of the room to the bathroom. Put the dippity-doo on. And she said, I'm sorry. She said, "What do you mean, sorry?" I said, "It's beautiful." And from then on, I just put the dippity-doo away and let it grow. Ella gave me the confidence to do it. That's probably the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me.
Heather?
And she wanted to get married. I wanted Heather, but I was nervous of getting married. I said, I'll marry you, but I can't promise you I'm going to be one of those good husbands. You know, and the business I'm in, and I'm away for so long, I would be lying to you very quickly. And I don't want to do that. I want to keep it in the open. Let's just be honest about the job I do.
But Heather must be an extraordinary woman.
She knew how much I cared about her. I think she knows how much I love her. You know, I think that's why she accepted that. And we're real partners, you know.
But
if we got divorced tomorrow, she can have it all. I don't give a fuck. I'm going to live back in the council flat. You know, that's how I feel about her. She's beautiful inside. Kindest, most beautiful eyes. She's very bright. And she's had a life. She's had a real life. She's Irish Glass Region, Shepherd's Bush, New York.
Ooh, that's strong.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very strong.
Don't fuck with Heather.
What have you learned about love?
What have I learned about love? Oh my God, I'm so full of it.
Full of love for everybody.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest problems.
Without a Heather in your life, would you still be alive, do you think?
Probably wouldn't. I could have become an addict quite easy. Yeah. I still have trouble with the sleeping pills now. You know.
You find that you have to take sleeping pills to sleep. What other things do you have to do to keep going?
I work out. Just try and keep as fit as I can.
What is the one thing that's made you who you are?
I don't know. I think just the family I came from, watching them struggle, and then meeting Heather. They're the ingredients that made me what I am. And of course, for some reason or other, I got lucky enough to meet John Entwistle, who introduced me to Pete Townsend, and then we found Keith Moon. And that chemistry of the Who was there. And it is chemistry. It was the chemistry that made it great. All music is mathematics, and Who's music, Pete Townsend's music's mathematics, are unique.
Are you proud of what you've achieved and of your life?
Oh, how can it not be? How could it got to be? I'm not proud of everything I've done, but I can't regret them as such. I don't know whether regrets would I do them now? No, I wouldn't. But equally, you learn from those mistakes. That's what makes you who you are. Fuck, I'll never do that again. You know.
Lived a great life.
Yeah, it's been a good life, yeah.
And still living it?
Well, hopefully. Hopefully. I mean, the world today is completely mad, isn't it?
Roger, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy. And let's do it again in another 20 years.
Oh, yeah, why not?
Roger Daltrey, literally the voice of my generation. I warn you, we're not going quietly. So that's Too Late to Die Young. Next week my guest is Michael Palin, or rather Sir Michael Palin. I wonder if I should curtsy.
I have had some very, very nice, apparently completely sarcasm-free emails from all the Pythons. My favourite was from Terry Gilliam, who said, "Glad to hear you've been knitted." Just in time for the cold weather. I thought that's perfect.
So that's Too Late to Die Young. I'm Nina Mishkoff. Production was by Tamsin Hughes and Lucy Ditchmont for Audio Boom. My thanks to our sponsors Imadine, to the H Club in London for recording facilities, and to Edwin Pearson for the music. If you like the show, subscribe, like it, or just tell someone about it. old school.